Side 10, Eon by Greg Bear. Continuing on page 386. "Well, I tried," he said, seeming chagrined. "I'd like to talk with you, if you don't mind." "I'm not sure," she said. "It might be important for all of you." She stood her ground, head bowed slightly, staring up at him, but said nothing. "We can keep on walking," Toller said. "I'd like to explain some things before you meet with the president, if he can make time for us."
"Let's talk then," she said, walking past him.
He took two running strides to catch up with her. "We're not your enemies, Patricia," Toller admonished. "Whatever Omi may have told you..."
"Omi has said nothing against anybody," Patricia said. "This is just my way," she said. I'm not very happy these days, for obvious reasons."
"Most understandable," the advocate said, keeping pace with her. None of the other bathers or floating neomorphs seemed to find it unusual for the president's advocate and a woman from centuries in their past to be walking together. They were casually ignored. "I find the resort here wonderful. I come often. Reminds me of what it is to be human. Do you understand?"
"To see things that are real," Patricia said.
"Yes, and to get away from the problems for a while. Well, this is obviously a working vacation, and brief at that. We can't stay more than 2 local days. But we thought it worthwhile to show you how our system works. We are trying to enlist your support. Patricia, may I call you that?" She nodded. "Because of the way things have worked out, you people can be very influential. We won't force you into our ways or opinions. That's not how our government works. Modeled on your own, after all." They stopped at a natural basalt breakwater pointing out to sea. Patricia turned and saw a small bright meteor pass across a few degrees of the horizon. No beams reached out to destroy it. It was small enough to disintegrate harmlessly on its own. "We helped the France install their sky lance," Toller said. "When we opened the gate, they were still in the early atomic age. We arranged for some exchanges of information, set up a client-patron relationship, and gave them what they needed to protect their world against the millennial comet sweeps."
"What did you get in return?"
"Oh, they received much more than Skylance for what they gave. We opened the way to them. They're full partners in 3 gates now, commerce with 3 worlds and the normal space trading systems around them. In return, they leased raw material and information rights to us. But the most valuable commodity they contribute is themselves. You met Olmi's partner. We find them ideal to work with. Resourceful, reliable, unfailingly pleasant. And as far as anyone can tell, they genuinely enjoy working with us."
"Makes them sound like good pets," Patricia said.
"Yes, there is that aspect," Toller admitted. "But they're at least as intelligent as we are. Unsupplemented, of course. And nobody treats them as if they were second-class citizens or pets. You may have to drop some of your past prejudices to see our situation clearly, Patricia."
"My prejudices are dropped," she said. "I'm just being..." She raised her hands and shook her head. Not once since their meeting had she looked directly at Toller's face.
"Before we came, every 1,000 years, Timble would pass through a sweep of old comets. They'd regularly lose more than half their population. All this ocean is cometary water, gathered across billions of years. Apparently there was a long lull about 1 million years ago, and in that time the France evolved to their current form and built up basic cultures. Then the sweeps began again. Gradually the individual France became more and more alike, passing information and personality traits on through chemical messengers, then through cultural means. They became a holographic society, the better to absorb the shock of the sweeps. But they had never realized their potential, and weren't about to, until our gate was opened. Now they have some of our own technologies, using high-speed pictures to update each other, or even exchanging partial personalities. All in all, I'm not sure who was the more lucky, the France or ourselves. We might have lost to the Jarts centuries ago if the France hadn't helped us." Patricia listened intently, filling in what she hadn't had time to research in the data service.
"Why can't you establish some sort of client-patron relationship with the Jarts?" she asked.
Ah, the jarts are quite another story. You know, of course, that we found them occupying the way when we first connected it to the seventh chamber.
So I've heard, she said, remembering what the rogue had told her.
The engineer had the misfortune of opening an experimental gate on the Jart home world. Time in the way was not yet matched with our own time. They were able to spend about 3 centuries in the incomplete way, making it their home, even learning to open crude gates. When the way was connected and opened, there they were, much as they are today. Strong, intelligent, aggressive, absolutely convinced they're destined to populate all universes. We fought a violent war with them and pushed them back in the first decades. Then we opened selected gates and filled the first segment of the way, down to 1X5, with soil and air. All the time we were building the Axis city, we fought skirmishes with them, pushing them back farther and farther, closing their gates. Finally, they retreated to 2X9, and we established a barrier at that point. We tried reasoning, making exchanges. They wouldn't have it. We knew we couldn't rid the way of them. We weren't strong enough. Patricia sat on the lowest step of a stairway leading to the top of the breakwater.
And how can we help you?
That's a complicated question, actually, Toller said. You can best help us by supporting us, or by not opposing us.
You can all go home now, Patricia said, such as it is.
Toller paused for a moment, puzzled by the abruptness of her leap of ideas. Exactly. He sat beside her, and she edged a few centimeters away. Such as it is. Personally, despite Sail Lanier's most heartfelt plea, I see little reason to return to Earth now.
You could help the survivors.
Patricia, they, you, become us. I see nothing iniquitous with letting a world heal itself. The fact that we've made a causal loop, that we can return to the worst point in our world line, is not what I would consider an opportunity. At the moment, it's a handicap. Has Olmi explained how we hope to push the Jarts from the way, for good? She shook her head. It's an ambitious plan. You've heard rumors about secession, having the Axis city divide in two. She decided to play dumb and shook her head again. Our flaw research group discovered years ago that the Axis city could be accelerated to near C, to near light speed. There would be no damage to the city itself, and the citizens would experience only minor discomfort.
I think we should all hear about this, Patricia decided suddenly, standing up. I mean all of my group, not just me.
They can learn as much as they want. You can guide them when they get back to the Axis city. It's all available in city memory, or Olmi can explain it to you.
Why hasn't he told us already?
Patricia, our world is extremely complex, as you know perhaps better than I. I doubt Olmi has had the opportunity to educate you on a thousandth of the more important things there are to know about us.
Okay, Patricia said, stepping onto the sand and facing Toller. I'm listening.
It would take over a day to approach that velocity, accelerating at about 300 G's, which is very close to the theoretical limit for the inertial damping systems, and for something as large as the Axis city traveling on the floor. The floor would be seriously stressed, producing hard radiation and heavy particles, but within the way, even a velocity of 1/3 light speed would create a space-time shockwave. We would reach that velocity at about 1.7x9. We would pass through the territories held by the Jarts with devastating effect. The relativistic distortions within the way would be incredible. The shape of the way itself would be altered as we passed, and whatever gates the Jarts have opened would be smoothed out of existence. He slid his hand in a flat-out gesture, like ironing a piece of fabric in one of your world's laundries. Patricia's eyes became distant. Her mind was racing now to absorb the idea of a relativistic object within the way, and the realization that within the way an object traveling at only 1/3 C would be relativistic. A grand scheme, don't you think? She nodded abstractedly.
How far would you travel down the way?
That's still being debated.
And what are the alternatives?
The conference is considering the alternatives even now, and have been for over 3 weeks. We believe the Jarts will break through our barriers in a matter of years, perhaps months. They'll overrun our most extended gates. We will shut them down and withdraw, of course. And eventually, by the end of the decade, they'll push us back into the Thistledown. We'll have to evacuate, and to keep them from following us, we'll have to destroy the way. That would be an incredible calamity.
You're certain about this?
Fowler nodded once. We cannot hold them for long. They've grown quite strong, and they've enlisted the help of other worlds by opening gates all up and down their segment of the way.
Couldn't you do the same?
As I said, they've occupied the way for several centuries longer than we have. They're more familiar with it in some ways than we are, even though we created it. Toller wasn't telling her about one of the alternatives the rogue had mentioned, blowing the thistle down from the end of the way and cauterizing it, sealing it closed so it would continue to exist independently of the sixth chamber machinery. She decided not to ask him about that possibility.
It's fascinating, she said. Gives me a lot to think about.
Yes, well, I'm sure I've violated all the rules of etiquette, Patricia. You've been very kind to listen to me. Our time is quite limited, as you see, and you've brought an additional element into the equation.
I'm sure we have, Patricia said. Perhaps more than you know. I'd like to walk back now.
Certainly. I'll accompany you. She smiled at him, eyes still distant. Toller said very little as they retraced their steps up the beach to the resort buildings, and that suited Patricia. She was already slipping into the state, her mind working, conjuring up her personal notation. Passing quickly through Lanier's room, she made a few excuses and retired to her own quarters, lying down on the bed and closing her eyes tightly. Toller greeted the others and spoke with them for several minutes, explaining he had had a good conversation with Patricia concerning subjects of importance to all of them. After he left, Lanier knocked on Patricia's door and received no answer. Patricia, he called.
Yes, she said softly, scrunching up her face.
Are you all right?
I'm resting, she said. I'll join you for dinner.
He looked at his watch. Their second meal on the Frant World, ostensibly supper, would begin in an hour. He returned to his room. How is she? Carolson asked.
Fine, she says. She's napping.
Not likely, Farley said. I wonder what Toller told her. Chapter 58. The meeting between the three men who had taken Mirsky's mantle of authority began and ended in half an hour. It was held in Pletnyov's private cabin, with Onyankovsky standing guard outside to make sure nobody listened in. The topic was Mirsky's message to Garabedian. The solution of the problem they now faced, Pletnyov insisted, was simple. At first, Garabedian and Pogodin were hesitant. Pletnyov had insisted they had no other choice, however. Look, they tried to kill Mirsky, and they were locked away, he said. Now they'll be released. Isn't it obvious? It's what the American woman thought. It makes sense to me. So what do we do? Pletnyov hefted his Kalashnikov. Most of the laser weapons had long since run out of charge, and besides, he had always preferred bullets. Won't we be locked up? Garabedian asked. Was anyone locked up after all the fighting? Pletnyov asked. Pogodin shook his head. Then we'll just kill them away from the city. I don't like the idea of killing them without a trial. We don't have any choice, Pletnyov said. Shit, Mirsky left you the message, but I'm the one who understands what he was really saying. Yergorsky still has his supporters. Without Mirsky, the three of us can rule reasonably. But if these Umpolites return, we'll all be shot. We meet them, and we do what we must. Agreed? Pogodin and Garabedian agreed. Then let's go, Pletnyov said. We'll wait them out. Better to be early than to miss them. Mirsky had abandoned the truck on the water's edge and walked inland with his backpack filled with dry rations. Finger lakes were plentiful in this area of the fourth chamber, and the fishing everywhere was excellent. He had little doubt he could survive. These forests were not meant to be harsh environments. In the regions where it snowed, roughly one-fourth of the chamber, in an area whose outer boundary was the 180 line. The snow was light, and it rained just often enough all over to maintain the chamber's plant life. He would hardly be roughing it. The first few days he had spent peacefully, doing little besides making an adequate fishing pole. He had read the American biologist's reports on the fourth chamber and knew there would be earthworms and grubs to use as bait. His anxiety tapered off, and he wondered why he hadn't bothered to leave sooner. He seldom encountered the boundary markers of his new mentality now. Either they were fading with use, or he had learned to ignore them. On his fifth day in the 180 woods, he found signs that he was not alone. A Russian ration packet and an American plastic container revealed that one or more Russian soldiers had found their way here. The discovery didn't bother him. There was room enough for virtually everybody, and in privacy besides. On the seventh day, he met a Russian at the edge of a grassy clearing. He did not recognize him, but the soldier knew Mirsky and quickly faded back into the woods. On the eighth day, they saw each other again across a narrow lake, and the soldier did not run away. "You're alone, aren't you?" the soldier asked. "Until now," Mirsky said. "But you're the commander," the soldier said resentfully. "No more," Mirsky said. "What's the fishing like here?" "Not so good. You notice there are mosquitoes and flies everywhere, but they don't bite?"
"Yes, I've noticed."
"I wonder why?"
"Good design," Mirsky suggested.
"I wonder if it ever snows."
"I think it does, once every year or so," Mirsky said. "But it doesn't get very cold, not like Moscow."
"I would like for it to snow," the soldier said.
Mirsky agreed, and they met at one end of the lake and walked through the woods together in search of a better fishing spot.
"The Americans would say we were Huckleberry Finn and Tom Sawyer," the soldier observed as they dipped their thread lines into a stream. "You know, the Americans aren't as bad as they were on Earth. I thought about defecting before I decided to leave for the woods."
"Why didn't you?" Mirsky asked.
"I didn't want to be around anybody. But I'm not sorry you're here, General."
The soldier bobbed the tip of his pole, hoping to entice a trout.
"Restores my faith in humanity. Even the general wants to get away from it all."
The soldier, who never told Mirsky his name, had left the compound weeks ago, before Mirsky's death in the library. He knew nothing of what had happened, and Mirsky did not tell him. He was beginning to feel like a normal human being again, and not a freak or a ghost. Having the time to sit and admire a drop of water on a leaf, or the way water rippled outward from a fish rising for an insect, was wonderful. It no longer mattered who he was, simply that he was. 2 more days passed, and Mirsky began to wonder if anybody would come searching for them. High-power telescopes could spot them easily, and with infrared sensors it wouldn't matter whether they were hidden under trees or not. By now, he suspected, the Zampolites were free again, consolidating their position of power, if Pletnyov and the others hadn't acted on his warning. He was only faintly curious about what had happened. What he missed most of all was night. He would have given anything to spend a few hours in pitch darkness, to be able to close his eyes and see nothing, not even the faint brown glow of shadowy forest light through his eyelids. He also missed the stars and moon. "Do you think anybody we know on Earth is alive?" the soldier asked one morning as they cooked trout in a flat press of stripped branches over a small fire. "No," Mirsky said.
The soldier bobbed his head and then shook it in wonder. "You think not?"
"It's not very probable," Mirsky said.
"Not even in the high command?"
"Maybe, but I never really knew any of them."
"Hmm," the soldier said. Then, as if it was relevant, he said, "You knew Sosnitsky?"
"Not really."
"He was a good man, I think," the soldier said, removing the trout and filleting it expertly with his shroud-cutting knife. He handed half to Mirsky and threw the head and bones into the bushes. Mirsky nodded and ate his fish, skin and all, chewing thoughtfully until he spotted a silvery glint in the trees behind the soldier. His chewing stopped. The soldier saw him staring and turned his head.
A long metal object floated between the trees and stopped a few meters away. Mirsky's eyes widened. It resembled a chromium Russian Orthodox barred cross with a heavy teardrop on its lower extremity. At the junction of the angled bar and the horizontal post of the cross was an intense glowing red spot. The soldier stood.
"Is it American?" he asked.
"I don't think so," Mirsky said, also standing.
"Gentlemen," a female voice said, speaking English, "do not be alarmed. We intend you no hurt. Our detectors tell us there is a corporeal individual here who has undergone supplementary surgery."
"It is American," the soldier said, backing away and preparing to run. "What are you?" Mirsky asked, also in English.
"You are the one who has received supplementary surgery?"
"I think so," Mirsky said. "Yes." The soldier made a peculiar grunt deep in his throat and crashed off through the trees. "I'm the one. Don't bother about him." A woman dressed in black walked slowly between the trees. Mirsky thought for a moment that she had to be American because of the uniform, but he noticed the style was quite different. And her hair, shorn to fuzz at the sides, with a sweep of crown hair cascading behind her head, was certainly not American. It took him some seconds to see she had no nostrils, and her ears were small and round. She stood behind the chromium cross and held up her hand.
"You're not a citizen of the Axis city, are you?" she asked. "Not an Orthodox Naderite?"
"No," Mirsky said. "I'm a Russian. Who are you?" She touched the bar of the cross, and flashes of light passed through the air between them.
"Will you accompany me? We are gathering all the occupants of these chambers. No harm will come to you."
"Do I have any choice?" he asked, still calm. Could a man who had died once already feel any fear?
"I'm sorry, no," the woman said, smiling pleasantly.
Judith Hoffman had just completed a marathon 9-hour session on the restructuring of the legal system for the NATO personnel on the stone. Darrell Wallace had insisted she return to the women's bungalow afterward. Hoffman had fallen asleep in her room immediately, so exhausted that it took her some time to crawl up to awareness, and a few seconds more to realize what had awakened her. The comm-line alarm was chiming. She hit her switch.
"Hoffman," she said, her tongue thick and unwieldy.
"Joseph Rimskaya in the fourth chamber. Judith, we're having a rash of Boojum sightings. I've seen two myself."
"So?"
"They're metal, cross-shaped, zipping over our compound and over the Russian territories, too. We followed some of them with our trackers. There must be 20 or 30 of them in this chamber alone. They're all over."
Hoffman gritted her teeth and rubbed her eyes before glancing at her watch. She had been asleep less than an hour. "You're at the zero compound in the fourth chamber now?"
"That I am."
"I'm on my way."
She shut off the comm line just as she received another call. This time Anne cut in and was dickering with the voice on the other end as Hoffman answered.
"Judith, I'm sorry," Anne said hastily. "Beryl told me to let you sleep, and I was away for just a second."
"Miss Hoffman, this is Colonel Berenson in the seventh chamber."
"Please, Colonel," Anne cut in.
"This is an emergency."
"Anne, let him talk," Hoffman said.
"Miss Hoffman, our sensors are picking up dozens, maybe hundreds of objects, large and small. Some have entered the borehole, almost certainly, and are in the sixth chamber by now."
"They're in the fourth chamber, at least," Hoffman said. "Colonel, coordinate with Rimskaya. He's made sightings, too. I'll be in fourth chamber on the next train."
She packed her small emergency case and ran down the hall, stumbling and almost falling at the head of the stairs. She grabbed a railing until her dizzy fatigue passed, then pumped down the stairs as fast as she could without breaking her neck. Anne met her at the bottom with a mug of water and stimulant tablets.
"Shit, what are these?" Hoffman asked, downing them.
"Hypercaffeine," Anne said. "Lanier used them all the time."
Hoffman slugged back two pills and the water.
"What is it this time?" Anne asked, her face pale. "Not another attack?"
"Not from outside, honey," Hoffman said. "Where are Wallace and Polk?"
"Second chamber."
"Tell them to be in fourth chamber, zero compound. Tell them to meet me there, or at the zero train."
Hoffman ran from the bungalow, shouting for a truck to take her to the second chamber. General Gerhardt ran on his stubby legs from the cafeteria, radio in hand, calling for Marines, and waved for her to follow him. Doreen Cunningham met them at the security fence and pointed wordlessly to two trucks idling beyond the ramparts. They were climbing into the nearest truck when the science compound alarms went off. Hoffman stepped away from the truck hatch and jerked her head back instinctively. Overhead, a barred silvery cross drifted at leisure. The heavy lobe on its end gave it a sinister and silly appearance at the same time. It reminded Hoffman of some outlandish weapon in an 80s martial arts movie. "That's not Russian, is it?" she asked, still slightly addled from interrupted sleep. "No way, ma'am," Gerhardt said, hand shielding his eyes from the tube light. The cross circled the compound, then rose to a needle-point speck against the plasma tube and vanished. "It's a real one. A boojum." With sunset, the sky dimmed to midnight blue overhead. Where the final flat reddened edge of the sun was being swallowed by the ocean, a dark brown shadow line of cloud began, twisting and veering from the horizon to zenith, where it broke down into frothy streaks, the edge of each streak catching an electric purple gleam. Farley and Carrollson had retired an hour earlier. Frantworld days were about 40 hours long. Lanier was thinking steadily and was not ready for sleep. He watched the sunset from the patio, Heinemann by his side. Patricia had not yet come out of her room after the conversation with Toller. Barefoot, dressed in shorts and a long-sleeved blue jacket, Olmy walked across the sand a few meters away, spotted them, and approached. "Mr. Heinemann, Mr. Lanier," he said, and they greeted him with nods, for all the world like upper-class gentlemen lacking only pipes, formal wear, and evening drinks to complete the picture. "Enjoying our stay here?" "Very much," Lanier said. "The first real weather I've seen in a couple of months." "A year myself," Heinemann said. "Much longer for me," Olmy said. "I haven't had duty on an outside world in..." He seemed to look inward. 15 years. "And I haven't visited this world in 50. "They keep you busy, Mr. Olmy?" Heinemann asked, squinting at him. "Very. How is Patricia?" "I understand Sir Toller had a talk with her, and she's been in her room since." "Yes," Lanier said. "I'm going to check up on her in a few minutes, see if she'll eat some food." "She has been under strain for some time now, hasn't she?" "Ever since she came to the stone, the thistledown," Lanier said. "We put an awful lot of responsibility on her shoulders. Too much, really." "You thought she might riddle the mystery of the thistledown?" "We thought she might tell us whether what was in the libraries would also hold true for our world. As it turned out..." "It did, and it didn't," Olmy finished for him. Lanier stared at him, then nodded again, looking back at the declining twilight. "She's been acting strangely, even considering the circumstances." Olmy leaned on the patio rail. "After we arrived in the Axis city, she and I had a very long and interesting conversation. She was eager to learn about the city, about us, and she was eager to fit in. She especially wanted to learn about gate opening. That's one of the reasons we're attending a gate opening soon. Had she told you about her ultimate plans?" "I don't think so," Lanier said. Heinemann leaned forward, meeting Olmy's gaze earnestly. "Before she was captured, she was going to the library to do some final work. She had a hypothesis that she could proceed down the way and find a place between the gates, in what we call the geometry stack regions. It fascinated me that she knew about such regions, that she had calculated their existence, because to understand the rudiments of wave theory is not necessarily to understand all the implications. She believed that she might be able to construct a gate-opening device and probe the geometry stacks."
"What are geometry stacks?" Heinemann asked, his voice froggy. He cleared his throat and glanced at Lanier.
"Gate regions are placed in specific rhythm along the way. They open onto clearly defined locations in universes slightly different from our origin. Each gate opening, heading down the way, will advance in time by approximately half a year in each universe. Patricia understood this very early, from what she tells me, but it took her some time to realize that the infinity of alternate worlds must be bunched by the existence of such clearly marked gate regions. The bunching occurs in the regions of stacked geometry, and the distortion caused by the bunching leads to gross displacement of some universes, both in superspace and in way-time.
"I'm not following you," Lanier said softly.
She believed she could open a gate into an alternate universe, an alternate Earth, where the death did not take place, yet where things were very little different from her world. She understood that gate-opening devices are tunable to a certain extent. It is her theory that, with one of our devices, she can open a precise path to an alternate and hospitable Earth.
"Can she?" Lanier asked.
Olney didn't say anything for a moment. "We will consult with two gate-openers. One is here on Timbal. The other is the prime opener, Sir Rai Oryu, father of Senator Prescient Oryu, and he awaits us at 1.3x9.
"Is that another reason why we've been removed from the Axis city?"
Olney smiled and nodded. "My reasons for bringing Patricia back with me were quite sound, but your arrival has caused no end of trouble. One visitor we might have been able to keep secret, though that seems doubtful now. 5 visitors, impossible. The president hopes to make you assets rather than liabilities."
1,300 years, and people are still people, Heinemann mused with an edge of bitterness. "Still squabbling."
"True and not entirely true," Olney said. "In your day, many people were so severely handicapped by personality disorders or faulty thinking structures that they often acted against their own best interests. If they had clearly defined goals, they could not reason or even intuit the clear paths to attain those goals. Often adversaries had the same goals, even very similar belief systems, yet hated each other bitterly. Now, no human has the excuse of ignorance or mental malfunction, or even lack of ability. Incompetence is inexcusable because it can be remedied. One of Ser Ram Kikura's services is to guide people in selecting appropriate skills and attitudes for their work. They can assimilate the necessary adjuncts, whether it be a set of memories or even a personality supplement."
"So why do they still disagree?" Heinemann asked.
Olney shook his head. "Know that, and you understand the ultimate root of all conflict in the realm of Star, Fate, and Pneuma, in all the universes accessible to us."
"It's unknowable, then," Lanier said.
"Not at all. It's all too clear. There can be more than one ultimately desirable goal, and many equally valid ways to achieve those goals. Unfortunately, there are limited resources, and not everyone can follow the path they want. That is true even for us. Our citizens are for the most part good-hearted, capable, and diverse. I say for the most part because the Axis city system is by no means perfect."
"What you're saying is the gods themselves would have war."
Olney agreed. "Interesting how the crude myths of our youth come back as eternal truths, no?"
Lanier knocked on Patricia's door and called her name. A few minutes and several more knocks later, Patricia opened the door and motioned for him to come in. Her hair had been mussed into twisted strands. She wore the same clothing she had worn at the beach. "Just checking to see how you're feeling," Lanier said, standing awkwardly in the main room, not sure whether to fold his arms or let his hands hang down at his sides.
"I'm thinking," Patricia said, turning to look at him. Her eyes were plaintive. "How long has it been?"
"Since you left the beach?"
"Yes. How long?"
12 hours. "It's dark outside."
"I know. I turned on the lights before letting you in. This place is just like a hotel room. That's what it's supposed to be, I guess. Quaint. Back to basics. That's what the president said."
"You don't sound right," Lanier said. "Something's wrong."
"I can't stop thinking. I've been in the state. That's what I call it. Deep thinking. I've been here for 12 hours now. I'm in it now. I can just barely talk to you, you know."
"Thinking about what?" going home. It all comes down to that.
Olney said,
Gary, I'm losing touch. I'm going to end up like that rogue, all distorted and unreal. I can't stop thinking. The president's advocate said, Gary, I need help. I need something distracting.
What? Lanier asked. She extended one arm and spread her hand, gesturing with her fingers. He gripped the hand.
I'm human, aren't I? I'm real. I'm not just some toy or program.
You're real, Lanier affirmed. I'm touching you.
I can't be sure of that now. You wouldn't believe what's in my head. I'm seeing... I mean, it's not artificial, not an adjunct or anything. It's from inside me, all the calculations, theorizing. I'm seeing universes bunched up like Bible leaves, and I know the page numbers. Olney didn't believe me, not completely, but I still think I'm right. They have these gate-opening devices, some big, some small. If I could get one of those, I could take all of us home right now, back to where everything is all right. I know the page number.
Patricia.
Let me talk, she said fiercely. Back to where there is no nuclear war, where my father reads Tiempos de los Ángeles, where Paul waits for me. So I'm thinking, but not just about those things. The president said they could send the Axis city down the corridor, the way, at relativistic speeds. Relativistic. Wipe out their enemies. It would work, but...
Slow down, Patricia.
I can't, Gary. I need touch. I need Paul, but he's still dead until I find him.
She gripped his hand tighter.
You will help, please.
How? She scrunched her eyes up as if facing into a wind and forced an uncertain smile.
The way would expand like a bugle if there was a large relativistic object traveling the singularity. It would balloon. It would shut gates, just fuse them closed.
How can I help? I'll get Carrollson.
No, please, just you. I've been making notes.
She held up her slate. The screen was covered with figures that made absolutely no sense to Lanier.
I have the proof. Let me go to the point in the stack geometry, and I can take us out. But I can't stop this.
Patricia, you said I could help.
Make love to me, she said abruptly.
Lanier stared at her in shock.
I'm just a thought right now. Give me a body.
Don't be ridiculous, he said, angry. Doubly angry because he felt a sympathetic response. She flinched.
Paul's dead. It won't be cheating on him. When I open the gate, he'll be alive again. But right now, he's nowhere. I know you've been staying with Farley. And Hoffman...
She had almost said the wrong thing, almost brought up the question of his responsibility for her, and both of them knew it.
I am jealous, and I'm not, she said. I like Karen. I like all of you. I felt apart from you, different, but I've wanted to be with all of you. I've wanted you to like me.
I will not take advantage when you're vulnerable, Lanier said.
Advantage? I need you. I'd be taking advantage of you. I am taking advantage, I know, but I just know what would help. I'm not a little girl. Right now, I have thoughts in my head even these people haven't come up with. Olney knows that. But if I think any more, I'm going to lose all of it. Snap!
She clicked the fingers of her free hand.
I'm probably not very good in bed, she said.
Patricia, Lanier said, trying to remove his hand from hers, yet not wanting to. She stepped closer to him and laid her hand on his stomach.
I'll be unfair if I have to be. Body's a tiger, brain's a dragon. Feed one to keep the other.
You'll drive me over the edge, too, Lanier said quietly. She lowered her hand to his erection.
I'm not just an awkward little genius.
No. He said. Patricia leaned her head back, feeling him, and smiled ecstatically, eyes closed. There was no more resistance left in Lanier. She let go of his hand, and he reached up to unbutton her blouse. When they were naked, they held each other tightly. Lanier kneeled to kiss her breasts. His eyes moistened at the feel of her nipples between his lips. Her breasts were medium size, very slightly pendulous, one noticeably larger than the other, the skin between them freckled a darker brown. Their size and shape did not matter. Lanier felt a sudden clean flow of passion, taking away all conflicting emotions. She led him to the bedroom and lay beside him as they kissed, nested shallowly together. He took hold of her hips and angled them and slipped deep inside, the muscles of his stomach and buttocks tight, compulsive. Then they rolled over, Patricia on top, and she slid against him, eyes closed but relaxed, as if she were making a gentle wish. She raised herself up, and Lanier watched their connected motion without his usual isolation, knowing instead a completion and wholeness that made no sense. There had been not a hint of this between them, simply of duty, working together. He had had that with others. And now he was in bed with Hoffman's little Chicana genius. He had been dismayed on first seeing her, he realized only now. His respect for Hoffman's judgment had hidden that initial reaction to Patricia's apparent fragility. He was inside that fragility, taking pleasure from her, all in the name of duty. And that was a laugh. Part of his dismay had been attraction. Patricia moved of her own volition to the expected climax. With Paul, she had found herself to be a natural at lovemaking. She could feel the state subsiding, storing itself away rather than dissipating. Her thoughts became pellucid. Here was a focus. She came and, after a short respite, continued moving. Lanier's hips arched once, then he fell back, and then again, higher, and he groaned against her lowered shoulder, and then her cheek, and opened his mouth in a stifled, quiet, hoarse scream. With the thrusting and release, he felt everything loosen, years of tension he hadn't even consciously known about. They lay together, silent for long, damp minutes, listening to the grinding breakers beyond the glass doors. "Thank you," Patricia said. "Jesus," Lanier said, and he smiled at her. "Better?" She nodded and burrowed her nose into his shoulder. "That was very dangerous," she said. "I apologize." Lanier turned her face toward him and clutched her head between his shoulder and his cheek. "We're both odd birds," he said. "You know that?"
"Hmm."
She nestled into his shoulder, eyes shut tight.
"You shouldn't sleep here tonight. I'll be okay. You should sleep with Karen tonight."
He examined her face carefully. "All right," he said. She opened her eyes, wide and square, and stared up at him. Now she seemed less a cat than some strange inversion of the neomorphs they had seen the past few days. They were human within, with strange exteriors. But there was something inside Patricia Luisa Vasquez, something that had perhaps been there all along, which was not precisely human.
"Only gods or extraterrestrials." "You're looking at me funny," she said.
"Sorry, just thinking how upside down everything is."
"No regrets?" she asked, stretching, eyes reduced to slits.
"No regrets." As he left her room, he felt his skin prickle. Looking down at his arms, he realized that of all the things he had seen in the past few days, none had given him goose flesh. Until now. Chapter 59. While day had not yet come to the resort, Olmi led the five of them to a waiting bus. Carlson called them puppy buses because of their large white tires. The air was still and cool, and the stars gleamed clearly and steadily in the powdery blue blackness. Patricia was quiet, showing no sign of what had happened between her and Lanier the night before. Nor did Farley betray any awareness. Lanier had returned to their room to find her asleep. Sleep had come with much more difficulty for him. Not since his adolescence had he put himself in such a situation. Ram Kikura ran across a stretch of blue-green grass and boarded the bus a few minutes later.
"The president is unable to join us," she said.
"How disappointing," Garrelson said, not sounding terribly sincere. "Troubles?"
"I don't know. Sir Toller, the president, and the presiding minister's partial are meeting now. You go on ahead. I'll stay here and follow the situation."
The bus's frant driver looked back at Olney, who nodded. They rolled smoothly across the lawn to a road paved with fine gravel, then to a white-top highway that circled the resort and aimed toward the dawn, now deep red on the inland horizon. Patricia smelled something sweet, quite unlike the rich, sharp smell of the Timble Ocean. A breeze was blowing over fields of low-lying, thick yellow stalks growing outside the resort boundaries. In the fields, Frant farmers in red, many-pocketed aprons, accompanied by small automatic tractors, were already at work. "They're harvesting biological personality elements," Olney explained. "Tailored plantimals replicate complex biological structures, right down to pre-assigned memories. A cottage industry, you might call it. Very advantageous."
"For humans or France?" Lanier asked.
"The plantimals can be adapted for most organics," Olney said. "Installation of genetic codes is not difficult for carbon-based forms."
Lanier had meant whether the industry was more advantageous to humans or France, but decided not to restate his question. The bus took the white road through the fields and crossed the densely populated coastal plain. For dozens of kilometers in both directions along the coast, and for at least 10 kilometers inland, the plain was covered with Frant villages. As many as 10 villages occupied tracts of land barely 3 kilometers square. Each village consisted of several nested circles of low-roofed rectangular houses. At the center was a stupa-like structure, often as much as 50 meters tall, draped with many colored banners. As the sun brightened, the inland-facing banners on the stupas changed color, waving slowly in the gentle breezes like despondent rainbows.
"How advanced are the Frants compared with your people?" Carrollson asked.
"More basic, but not primitive," Olney said. "Their grasp of technology and science, I assume that's what you're referring to, is extensive. Do not be misled by styles of philosophies, or even by gentleness. France are resourceful. We rely on them a great deal."
Beyond the fields and villages, the road spiraled around a low mountain crested with sky-pointing prisms of translucent gray rock. At the top of the mountain, resting on a plateau formed by the prisms, a squat white and copper-banded dome rose some 60 meters higher, ballooning at its base into a broad pavilion. The bus drove under the outlying skirt of the pavilion and stopped. Olney led them toward the well-kept but obviously ancient bronze, black iron, and white enamel works beneath the hollow dome. Standing beside a 5-meter-wide horseshoe-shaped mount was a muscular, apparently middle-aged man, naked from the waist up, a toolkit hanging from his broad belt. His skin had a deep brown color, with a faint rainbow sheen. 3 Frants stood at other points around the equipment, talking among themselves in low tones as they worked with polishing cloths. Above them all towered a huge cage of crisscrossing black iron bars, like a misplaced Victorian bridge.
"It's a telescope," Heinemann said. "It's beautiful."
"It is indeed a telescope," the brown man said, smiling. "The last the Frants built before our gate opened."
"This is Sir Rensselaer Yates, secondary gate opener," Olney explained, introducing them around. "He will accompany us to 1.3x9.
Yates unhitched his toolkit.
"This meeting has been long expected. Sir Olney has kindly kept me informed about all of you. The Frants indulged me by letting me tinker with their historical treasures."
He pointed with one hand to the telescope and the dome and pavilion, then donned a blue cloth shirt and closed it by pressing along a seam.
"There's not much need for gate openers now. The primary can do most of the work very well without us."
He approached Patricia.
"Olney's told me a fair amount about you. You've made some impressive discoveries."
Patricia smiled but said nothing. Her eyes, however, were bright and square, cat with a secret. Lanier felt a surge of pride, something else, as he realized how much she had improved since last night.
"I'd love to tinker with that," Heinemann said wistfully.
"Perhaps someday you will, or one like it. France are not much for preserving their past, I'm afraid." He patted the telescope mount.
"I will not be back here for some time," he said sadly.
To Heinemann and Carrollson he confided, "I'd ask them to keep up the work, but they'll be reassigned, wander off and homogenize, as France do, and it will start decaying all over again. In its day, you know, this instrument and 14 others like it were kept busy from dusk to dawn, searching for the comet sweeps.
He waved his hand, bidding them to follow him beyond the rim of the pavilion and across a narrow, flat field. At the lip of the steep precipice, they looked across the flatlands and the sea beyond. The France were already moving into the space age when we arrived. They had built thousands of missiles with nuclear warheads, fantastic, ingenious, and very jumbled technologies. Jerry-rigged, could you call them? It had been over 9 centuries since the last major impacts, and they were waiting. If this instrument or any of the others had sighted comets, then trajectories would have been computed by thousands of France-linking minds. Years it might have taken them, but otherwise they had only primitive computers. The villages would have been moved, placed in safer areas, every village on the planet in motion. They were saved from that. Still, this, raising his hand to the dome, was a noble instrument. He shook his head. Sir Olmi, lead on. I am done here. He hugged each of the France and touched their hands in the homogenizing gesture, though for a human it was purely a formality. They were about to board the truck when one of the France, standing in the sunlight at the edge of the pavilion, whistled and pointed toward the coast. Sweeping inland, 3 tiny white points were approaching the telescope. Olmi frowned. Mr. Lanier, please take your people back to the telescope. Sir Yates, could you stay close to them? Yates agreed and followed them back to the center of the pavilion. What's happening? I don't know, Olmi said. We weren't scheduled to be met by gate police. The 3 white points grew rapidly to full-sized blunt arrowhead craft. The craft circled the telescope and settled on the flat field to the north. The nose hatch of one craft opened, and out stepped Ollagand Toller, 4 gate district representatives, and a Frant marked with the green sash of diplomatic authority. Toller walked quickly toward Olmi, eyes directly on his. There are difficulties in the Axis City, he said. I'm instructed to cut off your visit and return all of you to the Axis City immediately. Please explain, Olmi requested. What are the difficulties? Kurzhanovsky factioners and Orthodox Naderites have taken illegal authority and cut communications between the precincts. The president has adjourned the JART conference and left Timbal and is now on his way back to deal with it. We must leave now. Wouldn't it be best to keep everyone here, Olmi asked, until the situation becomes more clear? It is very clear. The secessionists are trying to force the issue. Toller resorted now to tight-beam Picts. The color of his message was an agitated red-edged purple. Our guests are key figures in this dispute. You know that, Sir Olmi. Olmi did not Pict. I understand, Sir Toller, but you miss my point. Sir Yates is now ranking human on Timbal if the president has left. Toller sized the situation up quickly. You refuse to release them. I am operating under authority of the president. I don't refuse to release all of them, Olmi said. Only 2 will remain with us. You may take the others. Lanier began to protest, but Olmi shot him a glance that demanded silence. Toller backed a step away. I could order the gate authority to arrest all of you. No bluffing, please, Sir Advocate, Yates warned. Even an inactive gate opener is obeyed by gate authority. Who is the other you wish to stay with us? He asked Olmi. Mr. Lanier, Olmi said. Are you with the secessionists? Toller asked him, clearly angry now. Olmi did not answer. We will keep Patricia Luisa Vasquez and Gary Lanier, he said. You may take the others. We refuse to be separated, Lanier said, stepping forward, despite Heinemann's hand on his arm. You have no choice, Olmi said. We're past the point of euphemisms and diplomatic games, Mr. Lanier. I choose you in order that you may assist us with Ms. Vasquez. The others will be safe. We guarantee the safety of all, Toller said, except those who go with you, Sir Olmi. Sir Ram Kikura is their advocate. She will accompany these 3 wherever you take them, and watch out for them, Olmi instructed. Mechanical workers emerged from the craft and rolled or floated to surround Farley, Carrollson, and Heinemann. Gary, Farley said, her voice strained. They will not be harmed, Olmi reiterated. This is not that kind of struggle. The Thistledown is being cleared at this moment,
Toller said, hoping to arouse more defiance. Corp Rep Rosen Gardner is in charge of a campaign to evacuate the asteroid. Olney nodded, as if that were obvious. What will you do with Vasquez and Lanier? Toller asked. Please take the others now, Olney said. They are your responsibility. This is intolerable. When word gets down the way, gates will be closed, lanes cleared. That's what the Geshels planned anyway, isn't it? To expedite clearing the way of Jarts? That's the decision the conference was about to reach at the suggestion of the president, or am I wrong?
Toller glanced nervously at the secondary gate opener. You are cooperating with this secessionist?
Yates merely smiled, removed his torque from the toolkit, and picked at a symbol of Earth wrapped in a circular string of DNA. Shaking his head, the advocate gestured to the workers, who guided Farley, Carrollson, and Heinemann toward the waiting craft. Carrollson was livid with anger.
Are we just going to go along with this? She cried.
I don't think we have any choice, Heinemann said, his expression long and solemn. There goes Patricia's birthday party.
Watch your step, Gary.
Farley looked over her shoulder at Lanier, tears flowing down her cheeks.
Gary, she called back.
You sons of bitches, Lanier said to Olney and Toller. Patricia was right. We're nothing but pawns.
Don't underestimate yourselves, Toller said. He returned to the craft with the gate district representatives in his train. The diplomatic France stayed behind. The craft took flight again, heading toward the gate reception area.
My apologies for your distress, Olney said.
Now, we must proceed to 1.3X9 immediately. Things are happening much sooner than expected. Woogie Ma and Zhang Yixing carried boxes of equipment and papers out of the tent with the help of Berenson's troops, loading them into the back of a truck. A cool breeze descended from the southern cap, stirring the tent fabric. Except for their heavy breathing and footsteps, and occasional guttural exclamations from Berenson, the evacuation was conducted in silence. Six metal double-barred crosses hovered 3 meters above the road, their red spots seeming to watch every move the soldiers and scientists made. Far above, at the center of the plasma tube, something long and black was aligned on the singularity, no more than 50 meters from the opening of the borehole. Examining it through binoculars, Wu estimated it was 150 meters in length. It had arrived less than 10 minutes earlier, prompting Berenson to order the evacuation. When the truck was full and the tent empty, the soldiers crawled on top, and the Chinese took the remaining 2 seats in the front. Berenson grabbed a hand grip along the roof line and stepped up on the side ladder. The truck jerked forward and swung around to roll up the ramp. With the chamber deserted, the crosses bunched into a cubic formation, then flew off to circumnavigate the chamber floor. From the vantage of the floor ship, 25 kilometers above, an assigned ghost of Corp Rep Rosen Gardner watched the proceedings, relaying everything by direct beam down the way to the Axis City. In the Axis City itself, communications between the 3 rotating cylinders and Central City had been severed. Axis Nader was completely blocked off from the transport systems, and major sections of city memory, usually active around the clock, were now isolated and quiet. The tide had turned. The radical Geshels had tripped themselves up in their own haste to take advantage of Olney's news and the 5 guests. The incarnate Corp Rep Rosen Gardner had moved to the Nexus chambers a few hours before, risking the uncertain location in Central City to be at the center of all Axis City activity. He had created 4 partials to handle the details of the revolt. None of his factioners or supporters called it a revolt. For them, it was a necessary maneuver to protect their rights against action by radical Geshels. Whatever it was called, it was hideously complicated. Word from the Thistledown was incomplete, but that was the least of Gardner's worries now. His partials were in the 3 Axis cylinders and in the offices of the Way Commerce Committee at 9X6. His militant factioners held all strategic transport sites within the Axis City and along the way nearby. Through city memory and deep within the Axis City's infrastructure, Orthodox Naderites and Kozhinovsky factioners, his people, were consolidating the gains made in the past few hours. Sympathetic personalities in city memory, including his father, oversaw the interdicted communications nets.
Everything was proceeding as planned, yet Corporep Gardner was more unhappy than he had ever been in his 2 centuries of life. He cared little for the accusations of the presiding minister or the president. He had opposed them often enough in the past, and felt the sting of their power to relish watching them squirm. What made him miserable was the knowledge that the action violated all he had stood for in the Nexus, and all he had espoused before his election as corp rep by the new Orthodox Naderite precincts of Axis Nader. He felt peculiarly vulnerable, as if one of his own partials might chastise him for a breach of honor and faith. Already his factioners were preparing to move the city south along the flaw, toward the Thistledown. They would have to remove barriers as they went. That would take time. In the center of the empty Nexus chambers, surrounded by the armillary information rings, he awaited the return of the president and the senators and corp reps now convened on the Jart question. When they attempted to re-enter the Axis city and were denied, what Gardner called the action wouldn't matter. Then the revolt would have truly begun. A partial of the president appeared to one side of him and awaited his attention. Gardner took his time. Finally, satisfied that all was going well and that the partitioning of city memory had been particularly successful, Gardner allowed the partial to pick. "Do you have the support necessary?" the partial asked. "My original is on his way. Director Hulain Ramseja has already filed court proceedings. Needless to say, you haven't followed the usual Nexus procedures." "No. Emergencies and opportunities." His last statement pictured a wide range of emotionally charged symbols. The complex Naderite sign for home, consisting of Earth surrounded by a circle of DNA. This symbol engulfed in fire, replaced by a singed animal skull, and the requisite meaning qualifiers. Then, more straightforward, "Sir Ramseja can try his case after secession, in absentia. Besides, we are working now to have him tried for violation of Nexus procedure." "I've heard nothing of this," the partial said, incredulous. "You've been busy, Sir President." He regretted the tone of his response. The president had been working hard on the Jart problem, and he did not wish to imply any dereliction of duty. It was enough for his people to have taken advantage of the president's absence. "It was a minor infraction, but I am within my rights. As long as there is a court question, all of Sir Ramseja's duties are suspended. Senator Preetian Oyu is his replacement in command. She has left a partial here to carry on her duties." The partial of Van Hamfuis then picketed that he had protested the insurrection and tried to muster the votes necessary to override Corporate Gardner. Gardner already knew this. By legal maneuvering, and with the advice of Senator Preetian Oyu's partial, he had declared the vote invalid, lacking a quorum of incarnate senators and corp reps, and called by a partial instead of an incarnate. The fight was far from over. The incarnate Thies Van Hamfuis would be in the vicinity of the Axis city in just a few hours. Chapter 60. At the limit of the plasma tube in the 1st through 4th chambers, arrow-shaped craft patrolled back and forth. Other larger craft flew at will above the valley floors, and the double-barred crosses were everywhere. In the 4th chamber zero compound, Hoffman realized that any attempt at defense would be useless. The technology and the force they were up against was insurmountable. "There's no doubt they're from the corridor," she asked Berenson in the middle of the compound as they stood by a truck prepared to evacuate them.
"No doubt," Berenson said, accent thick with nerves.
"Then we can hope for the best." "And what would that be?" Polk asked. Her hair was wildly astray. For impeccable Janice Polk, that was a definite sign of frayed nerves. "That they're human. Our descendants." Rather than risk wholesale slaughter, she instructed Gerhardt to tell his soldiers not to fire unless directly assaulted. She could not, of course, instruct the Russians. They would have to figure out the situation on their own. Wallace and Polk helped with the communications. They spoke with several Russians on the radio, but the Russians refused to provide any information on their situation, though in all fairness neither of the women were able to get in touch with an officer. Rimskaya stepped forward and offered to take a message to the Russian leaders, on foot if necessary. That was gallant, but Hoffman refused. By the time the Russians received the message, the situation would probably have changed. Three crosses in a triangle formation flew over the compound. One broke away at the southern cap and returned to hover directly over the center and over Hoffman. Bright flashes of light appeared between Berenson and Hoffman. Hoffman jerked and stumbled against Rimskaya. Berenson stood his ground with eyes wide and nostrils flared. Then the cross spoke, its voice that of a woman. "You are not in danger. Under no circumstances will you be harmed. You will also not be allowed to harm each other. All occupied chambers are under Axis City jurisdiction."
"So what do we do?
Kowtow?" Beryl Wallace asked. Gerhardt approached them slowly, one eye cocked toward the hovering cross. "Jesus, that's scary," he said to Hoffman, in a whisper. "My people don't know whether to piss down their legs or bow in submission."
"Sorry, I can't reassure them," Hoffman said.
"What in hell is Axis City?" Berenson asked.
"I could hazard a guess," Hoffman said. "Where everybody lives down the corridor, on the Axis."
Rimskaya nodded too eagerly. "Talk to it, then," he suggested. Hoffman looked up and squinted.
"We intend no harm. Please identify yourself."
"Are you the leader of this group?"
"Yes," Hoffman said.
She pointed to Gerhardt.
"He's a leader, too."
"Are you the leaders of all groups in the chambers?"
"No," Hoffman said.
She didn't volunteer any more information, deciding a witness's approach to questioning would be best. Two of the larger blunt arrowhead craft flew by slowly and took up positions at the north and south ends of the compound, hovering about 25 meters above the surface.
"Do you guarantee the safety of a negotiator?" the voice from the cross asked.
Hoffman glanced at Gerhardt.
"Make sure," she said.
Then, more loudly in the direction of the cross,
"Yes. Give us some time."
Gerhardt used his radio to contact the units in all chambers.
"Are you prepared now?" the voice asked.
"Yes," Hoffman said, at a nod from Gerhardt. The craft at the southern point dropped gracefully to the ground, 10 or 11 meters from the center of the compound, lowering a single pylon as it touched down. A hatch in the nose dilated. A man in a black suit stepped from the hatch and quickly examined the compound, then focused on Hoffman. He had walnut-colored hair cut in 3 stripes, with shorter fuzz between. He lacked nostrils, and his ears were large and round. "My name is Santiago," he said as he approached. He held out his hand to Gerhardt, who was closest. Gerhardt took it and shook it once, then backed away. The man approached Hoffman and offered his hand again. Hoffman grasped it lightly. The man squeezed no harder than she did. "I apologize for your distress, whatever the necessity. I am instructed to tell you that all of your people are now honored guests of the Axis City," he said. "I'm afraid you can't stay in the Thistledown much longer, however."
"We don't have any place else to go," Hoffman said, feeling overpowered, more helpless than she had felt even when leaving Earth on the shuttle.
"You are in my care," Santiago said. "We must gather everybody together, your researchers, soldiers, your people in the boreholes, the Russians, and we must do it soon." Mirsky disembarked from the craft and blinked at the bright tube light. The interior of the craft had been quiet and dark, in sharp contrast to the bright glow of the 7th chamber. For the first time, he stared down the length of the corridor and felt as undeniable truth what he had hitherto only heard described. There had been so little time. The library had taken up whatever effort he had spared from being a leader. 5 other Russians disembarked behind him. All had been deserters in the woods near the 180 line in the 4th chamber. They, too, blinked and covered their eyes. They, too, stared in awe down the corridor, the implications of that vast distance becoming more and more clear. 1 kilometer to the west, hundreds of people gathered near the 0 tunnel. They were mostly NATO personnel, Mirsky saw, also being evacuated. The potato was being cleared, for whatever reason hardly mattered right now. The Russian he had met in the woods touched Mirsky's arm and pointed east. Hundreds of Russian soldiers squatted in a square, flanked on all sides by at least 12 crosses and 3 people he didn't recognize,
dressed much like the woman who had taken him captive. More blunt arrowhead craft descended and landed near the chamber's southern cap, disgorging more people. Nierske wondered idly if they were all going to be killed. Did it still matter, having died once? He decided it did. He still wished for the stars. Now the possibility of attaining that wish was remote, yet the wish itself informed him he was essentially Pavel Nierske. He still had a connection with the 5-year-old boy who had stared up at the stars over winter-bound Kiev. In fact, that memory was pure, not reconstructed, but original. Vyelgorsky had not blasted that most basic experience from his head. He wondered idly if Vyelgorsky and the other political officers were in the crowds of captives. What could they do to him now? Nothing. Only a Russian, Mirsky thought, could draw a free breath in such a situation as this. Senator Prishin Oyu joined them at the resort and informed Yates and Olme that the France were planning to close the gate, standard procedure in any temporary emergency involving the way. Olme acted quickly. Before the gate could be closed, Yates requested that a small defense flaw ship be prepared to ferry the secondary gate opener and his guests. The request was denied, but Yates tested his authority on the France side of the gate by appropriating one of the 2 Axis craft left on the reception field. The human defense forces there, mostly Naderite homorphs, decided to abide by the letter of the law and not Toller's party instructions, and gave the secondary gate opener what he asked for, as well as 2 guards and a mechanical defense worker. Taking the craft through the gate and up to the Axis, they found 3 flaw ships that had been disengaged from the Singularity to allow Toller's craft passage. One was unoccupied. It had been parked just minutes before and abandoned by its Naderite crew in a near-axis inspection area, tethered to the flaw by traction fields. Again, following the letter of the law, the crew had retired their small flaw ship for an inspection after 100,000 hours of active duty. Yates's authority easily overrode the flaw ship's ambiguous instructions. They boarded and restrung the flaw ship on the Singularity. The flaw passage through the center of the ship simply extended to the outer bulkheads, reshaping the craft's nose in profile from an O to a U, and then closed around the flaw. They accelerated toward 1.3x9. "You have a lot of support, don't you?" Lanier asked Olme as they watched the way blur into black and gold. "More than I would have gambled on," Olme said. "Radical Geshels have walked on the edge for decades," Senator Oyu said. "They have not been bad leaders, but they haven't prepared adequately for the fulfillment of their plans, and they have exacted a kind of revenge on the Orthodox Naderites by benign neglect. Now you see some of the results."
"Are you all Orthodox Naderites?" Patricia asked.
"No," Olme said. "I've long since given up that heritage, and Sayers, Yates, and Oyu were raised Geshel."
"Then why are you doing this?"
"Because there is a way for both sides to achieve their goals, if reasonable people intervene," Senator Oyu said. The small flaw ship was designed for speed and rapid acceleration. They averaged some 4,900 kilometers a second and reached the first defense station at 5x8 within 28 hours. The stations were located at 3 points along the way, from 5x8 to 1.3x9. Each was a solid 50-meter-thick black layer hugging the corridor's floor for 100 kilometers, the surface dimpled with weapons emplacements and field generators. At all 3 stations, the crews requested their mission and authority. Yates identified himself, and since the station personnel had no orders to prevent craft from moving down the way, they were allowed to pass. 100,000 kilometers beyond each station, mechanical flaw defense vehicles cleared the way for them, then resumed their posts on the Singularity, vigilant for Jart flaw ships or flaw-riding weapons. Within 50 hours, Olme decelerated their little craft and approached the atmosphere barrier at 1.3x9, passing through the axial hole at little more than a crawl, a few dozen meters per second. What lay on the other side of the barrier was unexpected and enchanting. For as far as the eye could see, the way resembled the 4th chamber in the Thistledown. If anything, it was even greener and more luxuriant. Clouds drifted at leisure beyond the plasma tube,
over a landscape of forested hills partaking of a palette of greens and grassy golds. Rivers cut bright paths through the hills, reflecting the tube light at every point to take on an aspect of shimmering silver. Patricia floated in the nose of the floorship, arms crossed. Prescient Oyu explained that this segment of the way was being adapted for eventual human settlement. The project had been started by those who wished to relieve the tensions arising from overcrowding in the Axis city. Even City Memory's enormous capacity was being filled and would soon need extensions. The way had other smaller segments adapted for human living, but on the whole it had been reserved for commerce. The segment at 1.3x9 was to have been devoted to Homors and their special needs. In short, it had been chiefly intended for Orthodox Naderites. A year before, the settling of this segment had been delayed by a Jart incursion beyond 2x9. Now the delay was indefinitely extended. The Jarts and their allies had grown in strength, and it seemed they might break through to 1.3x9. Still, the humans did not pull back. They did not settle the segment, but they conducted other activities, including opening a gate at 1.301x9. The verdant areas of the segment extended for only a few thousand kilometers. The floorship passed over a terminal building covering the gate through which the segment's soil and atmosphere had been brought into the way. They were accelerating again, over a stretch of sandy, barren territory, much like the region just beyond the seventh chamber, and then through another atmosphere barrier. There was no commerce in the next segment. No other gates had been opened. Except for three more defense outposts, the way was a featureless, darkly bronze tube along the entire million-kilometer stretch. Patricia contemplated the geometry of this undisturbed section of corridor. The geometry stacks would be of a different configuration without gates to bunch them, but they would exist. In fact, this segment might be ideal for her search. "Would you like to test your ideas here?" Olmi asked her quietly. She turned, startled, and nodded. "Sir Yates and I have been discussing your theories," Olmi said. "We feel you should present them to Sir Rai Oyu." Patricia's eyes narrowed suspiciously. "Would this have anything to do with Kuzhinovsky?" she asked, deciding now was as good a time as any to probe Olmi's secrets. Olmi lifted a finger to his lips conspiratorially. "If you wish to test your ideas, perhaps, but no more talk until our audience." At 1.301x9, they passed through another barrier. Beyond, a segment barely 60 kilometers long, lay velvety green under a thick and hazy atmosphere. Four small terminal buildings, little more than 100 meters on each side, were spaced around the as-yet-unopened circuit at the middle of the segment. A disk, a third as wide as the one that had transported them to the Timbal terminal, ascended from a white landing field near the zero terminal, climbing toward the flawship. Patricia's jaw hurt. She realized she was clamping her teeth and forced herself to relax. What was Olmi up to? And what would he and the gate openers possibly want with her? What could she exchange in return for the opportunity? They descended to the surface in the smaller disk. This disk was clearly more utilitarian in design. Its bottom half was opaque, and its only illumination was the steady glow of traction fields. A pie-shaped segment of the disk slid aside, and traction field chutes lowered them gently to the landing area. Olmi disembarked last. Prescient Oyu led them toward the terminal. "We can walk," she said. "I think it would be best to meet with Sir Rai Oyu immediately." They crossed the white pavement and then stepped on thick, fine-bladed grass. Oaks and maples were spaced evenly around the park-like grounds. Beyond the trees, the yellow terminal pyramid possessed only four steps, each twisted in relation to the one below. To one side of the terminal, a series of four traction pipes, each about 3 meters in diameter, wound for several kilometers around the terminal grounds, just above head level. Within the pipes, suffused by a faint violet glow, shapes not even remotely human, tracked over the landscape. "Our clients and allies," Olmi said. He pointed to one individual, an eight-legged cylinder with a mane of fuzzy antler-like appendages surrounding its bifurcated round head. "Talcet," he said, "tertiary form. They're a very old race. Their history goes back at least 2 billion terrestrial years. You'll meet another Talcet soon. One serves as assistant to the primary gate opener. The terminal was little more than a shell, about 100 meters high and 150 wide at the base. Within the terminal, a series of graceful gunmetal blue scaffolds curved above the smooth-lipped pit, about 50 meters in diameter. Hanging from the center of the scaffold, in an intersecting radiance of traction fields, was an object tiny in comparison, no broader than three hands. To Patricia, it resembled an old-fashioned Japanese pillow, with its neck-receiving curve. The base was forked, however, like the handlebars on a bike. She stopped by the edge of the scaffold to inspect it, knowing almost by instinct what it was and how important it could be to her. To Lanier, it looked like a divining rod with a radar dish attached.
"What is that?" Patricia asked, her voice small.
"That is what a gate opener uses to dilate the way manifold," Olmi said. She seemed to shudder.
"What's it called?" she asked.
"A clavicle. Only three exist. Rai Oyu has charge of this one."
"Where's yours?" Patricia asked Renslayer Yates.
"Inactive," Yates said. "Each is tuned to a gate opener. When the gate opener is not performing his official function, the clavicle is deactivated." She reluctantly looked away from the suspended clavicle and followed the others to the western end of the terminal building. There, under an incomplete cupola, roughly sketched from racing black and gold lines, a tall, thin man with close-cut Titian red hair stood next to a data pillar. Patricia looked first at the man, then at the cupola.
"Friends," Precian Oyu said, "this is my father, Ser Rai Oyu."
She introduced Olmi and Lanier. The primary gate opener nodded to each in turn. "And this is Patricia Luisa Vasquez," Yates said, hand on her shoulder. "I've learned the old language just to speak with this woman," Rai Oyu said, "and the old cultures and ways, yet she gives me such a peculiar look." Patricia straightened and cleared a slight frown from her face. "You were expecting something more impressive, weren't you?" Rai Oyu said. "Not the Wizard of Oz, I hope." He extended his hand to her, eyes narrowed in amusement. "I am deeply honored." Patricia shook his hand, her thin black eyebrows drawn together. Rai Oyu patted her hand paternally and glanced uneasily at Olmi. "Now this branch of the conspiracy is gathered. My researchers are at the first quarter location now. They'll join us in a few hours. They have no idea what's happened here. I'm not sure how I'll explain it to them. A person in my position, engaged in petty intrigues. Miss Vasquez..."
"I prefer Patricia," she said, voice still small, subdued.
"Patricia, do you have any idea what we've brought you here to discuss?"
"Some idea," Patricia said.
"Yes? Tell us."
"It involves my work on the corridor, the way, and it somehow involves Konrad Kuzhinovsky."
"Very good. How did she discover these things, Olmi?"
"I arranged for a rogue to visit her."
Patricia stared at him in shock, eyes square, touched with anger. "I see. And?"
"The rogue revealed certain facts to her."
"Something of a risk, don't you think?"
"A very minor one," Olmi said.
"She has the mystery, after all."
"Does she now?"
Rai Oyu approached Patricia. "Do you know what he's talking about? The mystery?" Patricia shook her head.
"No."
"Do you know how important this might be to us?"
"No, of course not. Too many questions."
"Patricia..."
"Olmi knows where a complete record of Kozhinovsky is," Patricia said abruptly.
It was a wild guess, but she hated appearing completely ignorant. "Actually, I doubt that," Sir Oyu said. "There are no complete records, not since the assassination." Olmi tied together what she had already heard bits and pieces of, the story of Konrad Kozhinovsky. Called the engineer, he had designed the inertial damping systems for the Thistledown and had overseen the in-flight maintenance of the Beckman Drive. Working from inertial damping theory,
He had then designed the sixth chamber machinery that created the way. That project had taken 30 years and had been accomplished by forging an alliance between the largely Geshel governing bodies of the Thistledown and the Orthodox Naderites inhabiting Alexandria in the second chamber. Kozhinovsky himself, like Olney, had been a Naderite by birth and had given his word that Naderite wishes would be carried out. What the Naderites demanded was that the creation of the Way not alter the original mission, which was to find an Earth-like planet circling the distant star Epsilon Eridani. The Naderites believed their principal mission of settling distant worlds in the name of Earth was a sacred obligation, the only truly acceptable reason for venturing beyond the solar system. But Kozhinovsky had not reckoned with a number of problems. First, he had not known that the linking of the Way with the Thistledown seventh chamber would in effect whipsnap the asteroid starship out of its native universe and into another. And he had not figured on the incredibly bad luck of having the experimental gates, opened by remote manipulation before the connection, allow Jarks into the Way and give them centuries to exploit their position. Kozhinovsky had retired his corpus into Thistledown's city memory soon after the first Jart Wars, in the wake of the ensuing scandal. Even there, he had been harassed. Finally, radical Geshels, judging him to be a Naderite traitor, had arranged for the purging of his personality records, in effect assassinating him.
"Then he is dead?" Patricia asked, confused.
"No," Olney said. "In city memory, he was supervising the construction of the Axis City. To do that, he placed partials of himself in different locations to carry on his work more rapidly. The most extensive partials were retrieved by his fellow engineers and entrusted to a woman who placed them in secret storage. This woman died in an insurrection in Alexandria a century after Kozhinovsky's assassination. She was an Orthodox Naderite, and at that time her sect did not allow implants. Her death was final. A century after that, the final Naderites were driven from Alexandria, and for a time some were kept in Thistledown City. I was born there, and while I was experimenting with the abandoned private memory banks of our apartment building, I discovered the hidden partials of Kozhinovsky. I was very young then. I only had a few years to become acquainted with the engineer, but in that time..." Olmi glanced at Sir Oyu. He had kept this secret for centuries and was reluctant to reveal it even now that the time was right. Sir Oyu nodded encouragement.
End of side 10.